Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here with Harriet Hageman this week, and we are delighted to have joining us as a special guest our colleague, a litigation counsel here at the New Civil Liberties Alliance, Adi Dinar. Adi, welcome to Administrative Static.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back in your case. I think you've been with us before, but in any event, we're excited to have you on today to talk about a case that you have just appealed to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. And for our listeners around the country who may not be attorneys, the First Circuit is Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire. Any other? Rhode Island is part of that?
Right.
So it's that northeast sort of corner of the country that that this case is being appealed to. And the case is James Harper v. Charles P. Rettig. And what's at stake here is that Mr. Harper is an investor in Bitcoin. So those of you out there who may have a little bit of Bitcoin or some other cryptocurrency, your ears should be perking up right now, because what happened to Mr. Harper is that he received a letter from the Internal Revenue Service saying that they had information that he may not have fully paid his taxes. And he knew he had fully paid his taxes, so this got him got his attention. And come to find out, the information the IRS had received was because they had demanded the information from some of the various organizations that folks keep their cryptocurrency with, and they didn't have a warrant. They didn't have any legal right to go obtain that information. They just asked for it and got it, and we think that's a violation of Mr. Harper's Fourth Amendment rights. But is this just about one guy and one guy getting his sort of financial information looked into, or does this case have wider implications than that, Adi?
So, Mark, this case has wider implications because at the heart of the case is the privacy concerns that these more than 10,000 taxpayers have, whose information the IRS obtained from third parties without any legal procedures. So at the heart of the case is the privacy concern, the Fourth Amendment concern that the IRS is not following the Constitution's probable cause and warrant requirements in obtaining this information from third parties. So here what happened was the IRS went to the digital currency exchanges and asked them to give information, financial information, private information of Mr. James Harper, who is our client, as well as some 10,000 taxpayers whom they thought were not reporting their cryptocurrency capital gains properly. So there was at least one digital currency exchange that protested to this illegal obtaining of information, but ultimately in that situation, the district court in California had issued a subpoena for that information, and that's one of the ways in which IRS likely obtained the information of 10,000-something taxpayers. And as a result of that, the IRS sent these letters to Mr. James Harper and 10,000 odd taxpayers, accusing them of not properly reporting capital gains on their digital currency transactions. Now, yes, Mark.
Well, I was just going to say, if there's a third party subpoena or a John Doe subpoena like this, if Mr. Harper never finds out about it and they never give him notice that they're seeking information about him, how is he supposed to go to court to defend his rights or vindicate his rights in not having that information turned over to the IRS?
That's exactly right, and that's the Fourth Amendment concern there, because this information is the property, the papers of Mr. Harper, and the fact that this is financial information just makes it that much stronger of a case to say that IRS has illegally obtained this information. Mr. Harper did not have any notice, as Mark, you just mentioned. They did not even think it appropriate to reach out to these taxpayers and obtain that information from the taxpayers themselves. They thought they would just go and tap into this database of information just because the digital currencies have all of that information, and that is wrong. Because imagine if you have a checkbook. That is your property. That the information contained in your checkbook or your diary is your private personal information. Without complying with the Fourth Amendment and without complying with the statutory restrictions that Congress put on the IRS simply was wrong in obtaining this information, and then based on that, accusing 10,000 taxpayers of not properly reporting their taxes.
And so one of the things that is frustrating about this case is that when you had this case in the federal district court, they didn't even reach these privacy questions because they said that there was no jurisdiction to hear the case. The IRS likes to raise the Anti-Injunction Act and the Tax Injunction Act as reasons why taxpayers cannot bring lawsuits against the IRS, or at least can't successfully bring lawsuits against the IRS. Can you quickly summarize for our audience what those laws entail, or what the Anti-Injunction Act means? Why the court said you couldn't, why it didn't have jurisdiction to hear the merits of your case?
Yes, certainly. So the Anti-Injunction Act is a very short statute that says any federal lawsuits that seek to enjoin the collection or assessment of taxes. If those lawsuits are brought in federal courts simply do not have jurisdiction. So the operative language there is the collection or assessment of taxes. But here, as we were just talking about, this has nothing to do with collection or assessment of taxes. Mr. Harper has paid all of his capital gains. He has accurately reported his digital currency capital gains taxes and paid them. This is not a tax refund action. This is not an action where IRS is actually collecting any taxes due from Mr. Harper. They simply sent a letter accusing him of not accurately reporting. So this is all about reporting. This is all about information gathering. This is not about collection or assessment of taxes. And the district court bought into this argument that the IRS made in the lower court that everything that the IRS does somehow relates to the assessment or collection of taxes. I mean, no kidding. I mean, it is the Internal Revenue Service.
Yeah, that's a bit like saying everything the SEC does relates to securities. Like, well, yeah, maybe in some ways it ought to, right? I mean, it's what they do.
Right. But, and it's not the case. And, a few weeks after the district court's decision, the United States Supreme Court decided a case called CIC Services, in which...
CIC Services LLC v. IRS, a May 2021 decision. And you were starting to say Justice Kagan said?
Yes. So Justice Kagan wrote the decision for the court. And Justice Kagan had this very, very helpful line in that opinion. She said, between the upstream information gathering and the downstream tax collection or assessment, the river runs long. And that is exactly this case with Mr. Harper. This case is about the information gathering practices of the IRS. It has nothing to do with the downstream or eventual collection or assessment of taxes. So based on the CIC decision, we are arguing in the First Circuit Court of Appeals that the Anti-Injunction Act is simply not a bar to this lawsuit, that in fact the district court had jurisdiction to decide the privacy issues, the merits issues in the case.
Terrific. Well, because the district court didn't have the benefit of the CIC Services decision, but the First Circuit does have the benefit of the CIC services decision. Do you anticipate that that will be a fairly open and shut part of the case at the First Circuit, or are there still some arguments that the IRS has about why CIC services doesn't apply to the facts of Mr. Harper's case?
I think it would be extremely hard for the IRS to argue around the CIC decision. But the other aspect of the case, which is upon appeal, is the IRS's argument that they have sovereign immunity from suit. And that is the second main argument that the First Circuit Court of Appeals will have to tackle in this case. The argument there is that because the IRS is a federal agency, they are somehow immune from this suit. But that obviously is not the case, because the Administrative Procedure Act is a mechanism that Congress put in place to sue federal agencies for if their final agency decisions violate the Constitution or do not comply with the statutes. And that is exactly what's happening here. The allegations are that the IRS took an unconstitutional sweep of these taxpayers' private financial data, and they did not comply with the subpoena statutes that Congress had put in place. So it is precisely the type of claim in which sovereign immunity does not attach in the first place. That's the argument we are presenting to the First Circuit, and hopefully that argument is also as open and shut as the Anti-Injunction Act argument is.
Well, yes, let's hope so. That would be fantastic. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens here. I mean, it might be the case that the First Circuit will just reach those issues that you talked about and won't reach the privacy issues. It may decide to send those back to the federal district court once it determines that that court has jurisdiction. But we'll stay tuned. And Adi, thank you for joining Administrative Static.
Thank you.
Harriet Hageman again with the New Civil Liberties Alliance, and today I am joined by my colleague and my friend, Peggy Little. Peggy, how are you?
I'm just fine, Harriet.
Wonderful. Well, I've invited you to come onto the podcast today to discuss some very interesting developments in some of the state bars around the country. And I understand that there are a couple of states now that have attempted to revise their Rule 8.4 of the Rules of Professional Conduct and are attempting to impose what I would describe as a speech code. Would you give us a bit more background information in that regard, Peggy, and then we'll just talk about the details of it?
Sure. The rule is known as Rule 8.4. And then in the different states, it has a different subsection depending on how the rules are organized in the individual states. But it was proposed generally by the American Bar Association. It's a model rule, and Vermont has adopted that rule in its entirety. Pennsylvania did a version of the rule that did require scienter. And now the rule is under consideration in a number of states, including New York and Connecticut. And in those states, New York and Connecticut, NCLA has filed comments suggesting to the either the committee that makes changes in the rules of professional conduct, or in the case of Connecticut, it's the judges, that this would be an exceedingly unwise rule to pass. And
well, and Peggy, how about if we talk about the specifics of the rule? Can you let's take New York's for example? Please just read to the audience what this rule requires or prohibits.
Sure, it prohibits lawyers or a law firm, and it says they shall not, quote, engage in conduct related to the practice of law that the lawyer knows or reasonably should know, is harassment or discrimination on the basis of race, sex, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, gender identity or expression, marital status, or socioeconomic status. This paragraph does not limit the ability of a lawyer to accept, decline, or withdraw from representation in accordance with Rule 1.16. This paragraph does not preclude legitimate advice or advocacy consistent with these rules.
That seems broad enough to drive a truck through.
Not just broad, but exceedingly vague. And one striking feature of that rule is that it does not require a showing that the lawyer intended to discriminate against or harass anyone. And it should be noted that in these states, there are already rules that if you intentionally violate Title VII or various other anti-discrimination laws, that can affect your conduct as an attorney. But those are much more sensibly written rules that require intent and that follow the laws that prohibit anyone, including attorneys, from discriminating against people. This is
it's a whole other ballgame than what has historically been considered, number one, controllable or something that can be, legislated out of existence. This really goes to a very subjective idea of what could be considered harassment or discrimination. And it's kind of that it is in the eye of the beholder.
Absolutely. Or the complainant. And what this permits people to do is to bring a grievance action against attorneys if they don't like what they say. And in this world of today's cancel culture, in the fact that many legitimate issues are litigated in the courts, discussed at bar and attorney meetings. Anyone suggesting, for example, that let's say a cake baker has a right to, a religious right to refuse to bake a cake for a wedding. If you were to talk about that or advocate the position of the baker, would be very easy for someone to see that as offensive to them or their orientation, and they could bring a claim against the attorney.
Again, a very standardless type of approach. Because anybody who would be offended by someone saying, I think that you have a constitutional right to serve, to exercise your religious beliefs. And if someone is offended by that in these states that are looking at adopting these model rules, they actually could be subject to sanction and they could be prevented from engaging in the occupation of their choice.
And these rules violate Supreme Court precedents, and this is important to note that in particular, a couple of cases, one is Mata versus Tam, and the other is commonly known as Becerra. And in both of those cases, the Supreme Court holds that the First Amendment protects professional speech just as fully as other forms of speech, and that lawyers are entitled to the same protections, First Amendment protections over regulation of the content of their speech, as does the general public. So the rules are fly in the face of important Supreme Court precedents that protect our First Amendment rights.
And that is very interesting. We're talking about bars. We're talking about state bars. We're talking about attorneys. We're talking about attorneys who should be attorneys, and in case of Connecticut, judges, individuals who should be intimately familiar with the issues surrounding the First Amendment, the freedom of speech, the freedom of association, the freedom of assembly. All of those things are potentially implicated by this particular speech code. And you would think that if there was one group of people that would be loath to try to step in and police something like this or to attempt to adopt a rule that so clearly violates the precedent set by the United States Supreme Court, it would be the people who are adopting this. It seems to be a very strange approach when historically we have always said more speech. If you want to combat bad speech, you have more speech. You don't attempt to restrict how people can communicate. Yet this is clearly an effort by these states to make certain topics absolutely off limits. And if you make topics off limits, you make the ability to even address the foundation or the philosophy or religious beliefs, you make all of that off limits. And I guess why I use the word so overly broad, because this has implications that are so enormous in the United States when you think about our long history of protecting freedom of speech, even noxious speech. It really, that's the point of it. The point of the First Amendment is to protect the right of people to say things that other people disagree with. If it was only to protect speech that we all agreed with, we really wouldn't need the First Amendment anymore, would we? It really is to stop people from discussing things that other people don't like.
And this speech code, which Eugene Volokh has blogged on and spoken about, as well as other professors of law who are more familiar with the Supreme Court authorities than the bar officials seem to be, will have a chilling effect for sure on people. I mean, we are living in a world, cancel culture world, where speech is already chilled enough because people are concerned about being, you know, shunned on social media. But for lawyers to then inflict this rule on themselves is not only contrary to Supreme Court authority, but is ultimately self-destructive and destructive to their roles as attorneys who should be free to advocate positions that may be unpopular. That's an important aspect of our culture. I mean, civil rights era, in the civil rights era, people could have been shamed for standing up for civil rights. And so you have to look at this in terms of how the First Amendment has worked over the course of centuries. And this kind of rule could have been used to silence people advocating that, you know, everybody should be able to ride on a bus sitting on any seat they want to.
That is the point. The point of the speech codes is to prevent people from engaging in the very discussion you're talking about.
Right. And when you look at the comments and the defenses of these speech codes, they like to say, well, just trust us. We wouldn't do anything dangerous. And for example, in the case of Connecticut, the grievance officials that look at your case in the first instance include non-lawyers. And they're definitely appointed by a state bar association that leans left. So what mm-hmm. you have is attorneys who have their license to practice law sitting at the mercy of people who are appointed by bar associations who typically have more left-leaning views. And the just trust us assurance is really an empty promise when so much power rests in the state authorities, and unelected policymakers get to decide whether you get to practice your profession.
Well, and first they're coming for us, but the reality is these are the types of speech codes, whether they are trying to impose them on university campuses or even in schools, K-12, that sort of thing. So this is a concerted effort to stop the discussion and to prohibit people from exercising their First Amendment rights. And when it comes down to just trust us, call me a skeptic in light of what has happened over the last year with our various Facebooks and different things, different organizations, different companies, quelling speech that they dislike. And so I can't trust them. I also just want to make a quick point, which is that this kind of rule has been struck down in Pennsylvania, which is a step in the right direction. Thank you, Peggy, for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.